Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Remember the conversation we had earlier this year around Ellie's, the technology group and manufacturer, which essentially has gone into business rescue and since then has been liquidated? Well, the brand itself is actually going to be resuscitated, given the fact that it still has a very strong holding in the South African environment when it comes to its sub-brands that essentially produce a lot of electronics, generators as well, and even batteries that have proven to be quite prominent in the local South African environment. So we thought let's deep dive into what actually purchasing or rescuing a brand means, even though the business might have gone into liquidation. Following this, we'll also take a look at a few other South African family-owned businesses that have really grown, evolved, gone to the point of listing, and perhaps had to regroup and re-strategize in order to improve their competitive positioning in the country. Andrew Bauman, who is the Chief Executive for Corporate and Advisory Deal Leaders International, joins us now to help us unpack these pertinent stories and using these companies as key case studies. Andrew, such a pleasure to have you with us, and thank you for making time.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm excited to speak to you because I always feel as though when we talk about businesses and companies that we've all interacted with, that we're familiar with, and have a very clear understanding that are family-owned, built, and have... I guess, really shifted the lives of many South Africans, it becomes a lot more practical to understand the intricacies of entrepreneurship and actually building organizations in a country like South Africa. And maybe let's just touch on what we are seeing. It almost seems as though the last three decades we've seen phenomenal businesses being built, but a significant shift that the environment perhaps might be impacting them negatively, whether it's Sasfin, Ellie's, or even the likes of Bell Equipment.
Yeah, look, I think so. I think it's like any environment. I think as you, the entrepreneurial space, you know, you set yourself up for success. But when it starts crossing decades, you know, so much has, you know, changes almost daily these days. There's a need to remain competitive, to be innovative and to change with the times. You know, often when you see some of these businesses, you know, that's, I'm going to say founder-led and family-led. You know, if they're fortunate enough to have multi-generational skills that help them to, you know, remain competitive and change with the times, you know, that's one thing. And then, you know, another thing is when they don't and succession isn't necessarily there and their recipe hasn't evolved sufficiently, it unfortunately just creates a lot of challenge and makes the competitive landscape a lot more difficult. And, you know, when you find these entities that are listed, you know, it's an onerous process. Mm-hmm. You know, your valuation is so vulnerable in situations when, like, you know, like an Ellie's, you know, presents itself. The dynamics just take the almost the rug out from underneath you and you're left with very limited options.
Mm. I'm glad you mentioned this. It does raise concerns, though, for us as investors, right, who want to put our money into some of these entities. But essentially, the businesses do need to grow and survive. Let's talk Ellie's. Yeah. I was intrigued by this update because the business is liquidated. So one would assume that it would essentially cease to exist in every form. Mm. But from what we understand, SMD Technologies is actually acquiring the brand. What's the difference between actually resuscitating a business versus the resuscitation of the brand and the purchase that's taking place here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, one almost, you the entity itself is a living body, you know, for want of a better description, a standalone body. And obviously within that, there's, you know, a whole lot of organs, if you like. And I think the big difference between, I suppose, buying the brand and buying a business, when you buy the business, you buy it all in. So the brand is one element of that business, but the legal entity itself is, you know, is a component. And then within that, there's employment contracts, there's assets, there's liabilities, there's, you know, footprint if it owns property, whatever it may be. But what's interesting on the SMD, from the SMD perspective, they've almost taken the best out. So they're taking the name Ellie's, the respected and trusted brand, but they're leaving everything else to essentially either be sold off or be liquidated. So it's a clever move, and it's, you know, for want of a better description, I guess if you were to buy an established brand out there, whatever that may be, and, you know, it could be a German car manufacturer brand, and you buy that brand, you can then take that name and put it onto pretty much any product that, you know, if you're bringing in another car, whatever it may be, you can put it onto any product, and you've got 30 or 40 years of pedigree and trusted name on a product that, you know, may not necessarily have been in the original mix. So yeah, it is quite interesting. I think the real complexity comes when you try and value that brand. So, yes, you know, that would be a great case study to get line of sight of at some stage. But yeah, it's, you can absolutely buy it out. And then what's going to be left over in Ellie's will be, you know, some assets. And obviously from a liability perspective, who knows what that's going to look like.
Gotcha.
But it leaves the more bricks and mortar, I guess, and nuts and bolts versus the sexiness of a very respected brand.
Mm. Andrew, so if I'm understanding you correctly, as you say, this, the brand is something that they can attach to any product that perhaps might be imported from another country. So I guess being manufactured in another environment. But I'm keen to talk brand equity for a moment, because you spoke about value. And I think this is typically the ongoing battle that takes place between financial executives at the C-suite versus the marketers, right? To say that there is brand equity, there is value in a name. And when people see Ellie's, they're happy to pay a premium for it. Typically, how is that determined in a transaction of this nature, where already the company perhaps isn't in a favorable position to fight for more?
Yeah, it's probably one of the hardest things to do. So I'm married to a marketing executive, I've learned a lot from her, so that does help me. It is a very tough one. And, you know, there's, you know, back in the day when you did valuations, you almost took the net asset value of a business, and then there was this thing called goodwill that was between that and what the price that was actually being paid. And, you know, technically, if you were to describe what a brand is, it's an intangible asset. So it's an asset that could sit on a balance sheet, but in many cases, it's not actually valued. You know, so how do you take that 30 years or whatever it may be of an existing brand like Ellie's and attribute a value to that? And there's many ways to, I suppose, skin the cat, but probably at the end of the day, it comes down to a really tough negotiation. But often the valuation is not necessarily driven by the brand itself only. It is driven by whoever's buying it, what they can do with it.
Mm.
So, yeah, you know, it's like I said, there's no set formula to determining brand equity. You know, the marketers and the assessments that are done globally, you know, there's so many qualitative and quantitative aspects that they bring into it, you know, based on, you know, standings in social media, how much is spent in the market to build a brand and but in a situation like this, it gets down to quite a quantitative measure that one needs to try and determine, you know, what is this brand actually worth? Because particularly from the seller's side, you're going into liquidation. You know, what number do you accept? You know, anything north of zero, I guess, is positive. But, you know, if you were to look over the years, what is that embedded intangible value and goodwill really, really worth? I guess time will tell whether S&D have paid the right price or not. So it is quite a difficult question to answer. It's extremely subjective. And normally in a going concern, it's much easier to value, but in a situation like this, one's almost going to take a scalpel to it. I would be keen to see how they did value it, because you can't apply discounted cash flows because you haven't got a going concern.
Yeah.
You can't apply multiples of profit or EBITDA or whatever that may be because you haven't got a going concern. If you look at the historical performance, obviously it's ended up in a situation that's really, really tough for it. I think it will come down to some really good negotiating around the table at the end of the day.
Very true. And I guess listeners like myself, and because I typically always think of Ellie's and I think of the bunny ears television aerials and Aerial King that they typically had in our households growing up, right? And that's just stuck with me. So I hope your wife will be impressed with my analogy of the brand equity and how it's still living.
She absolutely will be. I can tell you right now, she will be.
Exactly. Yeah. Perhaps let's shift on to another company that's also looking to change its strategy and subsequently delisting from the JSE, and that's Bell Equipment. As we know, big equipment and a company that operates within the forestry and agricultural space, but also with deep, strong ties in terms of being a family-owned business in South Africa.
Absolutely. You know, I've had the privilege of interacting with some of the family as well over the years. And like I said earlier, you know, we've seen quite a shift from a JSE and listing perspective. So, you know, if you went back 20 years, there was a real reason, strong reason, to list, particularly in growth businesses, raising capital and the likes. And I think there wasn't as an established, you know, private cash market or investment market as there is today. And I think, you know, as those businesses grow, you become, you know, more and more subjected, I guess, to those elements that are out of your control from a market cap price, you know, on your share and the likes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, based on the liquidity of your share, the ability to raise capital is not as easy, you know, as it used to be. And then you overlay that with, you know, the rigorous requirements of a listing. And in a situation, you know, like Bell's, where they also, you know, they've got a strong international market as well, you start, you know, asking the question, you know, how necessary is a listing versus what they could do, you know, back in their private capacity, because they have revitalized the business and it really is, you know, performing well. And so it doesn't surprise me that in situations, and I think it is definitely one of those families where there's from a family perspective, they've got real depth in their skills, you know, be it multi, you know, generational, you know, so the ability exists for them to keep it in the family and grow it out from there. So yeah, never great to see a delisting, from a JSE perspective, but you know, if I were in their shoes, I'd probably be looking at the same thing.
Andrew, I am so intrigued because I can imagine, you know, looking at your title, you take care of corporate and advisory at Deal Leaders International. So you really help businesses navigate the next trajectory of growth. And there's a plethora of factors that can influence that. As you've touched on, sometimes it's just the operating environment and the macroeconomic surrounding it. But I'm keen to understand internally, what have been the top themes that influence a company to either grow and evolve to such an extent that it should list, and perhaps when it's just best to be a privately owned business in order to navigate the changes that need to take place. And I'm specifically intrigued by family owned businesses, because we've seen similar themes with the likes of Pick and Pay, I guess shifting their strategy, and the family scaling back on their shareholding and executive leadership, and even with the likes of Sasfin Bank, which has also seen the leadership evolve from generation to generation.
Yeah, look, we would probably need to have a series of conversations. I think there are so many elements, you know, and one that starts with, you know, with the nuclear family itself, and ultimately what is the legacy of the family, and what is it that they ultimately want to achieve. Often what happens as well is these businesses can, you know, post listing can grow rapidly, and in many cases it can actually outgrow the family, and then you know that brings in a whole different set of risks. But if you were to ask me the one metric, I guess, you know, what is that one element that's going to impact whether you go private, stay private, or list or whatever it is, it's, you know, it's probably economics around the cost of funding. And you know, I think when you look at the trade-off when you've listed and what the market is saying what your business is worth, you know, based on the tradability and the multiple or PE ratio that it's trading at, and you compare it to what's happening in the private market, and if you were to raise capital, what would the cost be, and based on transactions in the private market, what would the valuation of your business look like? And if the two, you know, the listing position is not significantly better than the private option, because the private option qualitatively also comes with you maintain control. You're now not subjected to, you know, third party or institutional shareholders. You kind of do the pros and cons, and it'll hopefully give you a good indication of what the right route is. It's also about where you need the capital. So if you have got from a Bell perspective, by way of example, if you've got a European operation, is it easier then to fund it out of Europe directly, or do you try and fund it out of, you know, the JSE in South Africa? So yeah, it becomes a little bit of a matrix, you know, situation, as well as, you know, you use the example, a good one around Pick and Pay. You know, as the family shareholding dilutes, the strategy changes, you know, new leadership comes in and change the direction, you know, it's often just it's a natural I suppose, disinvestment by family often because you haven't got control anymore. And, you know, I think it, you know, you think about the legacy that you build over a long time. If someone else is driving the ship, but it's kind of going in a different direction to where you, you know, the heyday when you built it and the direction it's going in now, you know, you may want to, you know, deprioritize some of your investment in the entity as well.
Sure. So intriguing. Andrew, I could talk to you all day. This could be a beautiful
That's
master's
good. Yeah. You got my number. Give us a shout.
Perfect. Definitely. I just might apply to be your intern as well, just to keep
on
learning.
Oh, my goodness. You'll teach me, I'm sure.
Fantastic. We'll have to leave it there for today, but truly appreciate your time in helping us get a better understanding of, I guess, the dynamics of building successful business in South Africa, but understanding that there's a multitude of factors that do contribute to the growth trajectory as well as a transformation of businesses as well in terms of growth.
Perfect.
Thank you again, Andrew.
Awesome.
Take care.
Thank you, Gugu.
Thank you. That's Andrew Bellman, who is the Chief Executive for Corporate and Advisory at Deal Leaders International. And I think Andrew's given us such a beautiful understanding to really sit back and perhaps also appreciate that we have amazing businesses that have been built in South Africa. Think about Pick n Pay, Dis-Chem, Sasfin, Ellie's. What we see as well with Bell Equipment. And these are just a few that I'm naming, but it really does contextualize that these are businesses that have been in the industry for what? Almost three decades, some even longer. But it helps us understand that, yes, times might have been different in terms of the political environment in South Africa. So the levels of support financing, funding, licensing would have been different pre-1994. But the fact that these businesses have been able to evolve over the series of time and some due to unfortunate incidences that have been, you know, either impacted their operations, their strategic direction, or the macroeconomic environment, then have actually met their demise. But it does tell us that we really are able to invest in sustainable businesses to such a point that they eventually list. And if you think about it, that's typically what the mandate is for many businesses in South Africa when you choose and opt to industrialize, making sure that essentially businesses grow so well and so successfully that they shape and shift industries, that they allow and facilitate for employment and fundamentally are able to raise capital, not only on the domestic stock exchange, but even internationally. There's so many more companies I can add to that name and the list of South African family-owned businesses, or at least proudly South African businesses that have gone on to thrive. Even when you look at Naspers, started off as Mnet back in the day, very different dynamic, but it's obviously evolved into a juggernaut of an institution that it is at the moment. And many others can certainly be listed. But that's a conversation for another day.
You missed it live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.